Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padre Greedy, Richard Sanderson and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Welcome to Little Atoms. I'm Rebecca Watson, and I'm here with my co-host, Neil Denny. Neil, why don't you go ahead and introduce our guest for tonight?
Thank you, Rebecca. Our guest tonight is Arthur I. Miller. Arthur I. Miller is a Professor Emeritus of History and Philosophy of Science at the University College London. He is the author of several acclaimed books, the most recent of which are Einstein, Picasso and Empire of the Stars, which was shortlisted for the 2006 Aventis Prize for Science Books. An experienced broadcaster, lecturer and biographer, he is particularly interested in the relationship between science and creativity and noted for being able to write engagingly about complex social and intellectual dramas, weaving the personal with the scientific to produce page-turners that read like novels. Arthur's latest book is 137, Jung, Pauli and the Pursuit of a Scientific Obsession. So Arthur, thank you very much for joining us on Little Atoms tonight.
It's a pleasure, Neil and Rebecca, to be here.
So let's talk first of all about why you decided to write this book. Wolfgang Pauli, I suppose we should talk about first, and he's the physicist, so let's talk why you chose him as a subject.
Right, well, actually it was almost by accident. While wandering around and widening the library at Harvard University, I came upon a book written by Wolfgang Pauli and Carl Jung. I thought a very unlikely combination. Pauli I was acquainted with as a physicist, and Jung I had read something about regarding my work on my interest in creativity. The two of them, the combination really intrigued me. I mean, what did the apparently austere Germanic Austrian physicist Wolfgang Pauli have to do with the iconoclastic psychologist Carl Jung? There were two articles in the book. The one by Jung is on synchronicity. It's what one would expect, meaningful coincidences and alchemy and so on and so forth. And the one by Pauli is concern Johannes Kepler, who was a 17th century scientist, mystic, alchemist, and Kabbalah expert. Pauli's article was the real eye-opener. It's an authoritative and passionate account of Kepler's work and shows an expert knowledge of alchemy, mysticism, and religion. And another eye-opener past this is that Pauli argues that despite the opinions of his colleagues, Werner Heisenberg and Niels Bohr, quantum mechanics is not the final word, because quantum mechanics deals essentially with dead matter, with protons, electrons, and neutrons, and it does extremely well with that. It's the best scientific theory ever formulated, most accurate at any rate. But it has nothing to say about biology or about consciousness. So he was a totally different person than when you see exhibited in Pauli's scientific papers and what the ordinary physicist knows about Pauli. So what was the connection between Pauli and Jung? Who was the real Pauli?
So, well, let's talk about what that connection was then, because Pauli went to Jung for psychoanalysis, basically. So why did he turn to him for help?
Well, in 1932, Pauli was at a very low point in his life. He felt that he wasn't doing well professionally. His social life was a disaster. And as he had before, he had delved into the world of drugs, alcohol, and prostitution. And he was at an all-time low, and it was suggested to him that He was at the Swiss Polytechnic Institute in Zurich, and in fact his father recommended that his son, Wolfgang, go and see the celebrated psychoanalyst Carl Jung, who lived just outside of Zurich. And Pauli went to visit Jung, and Jung reports when he first saw Pauli was in a totally disheveled state. And as Jung put it, it was like the wind blew over from the insane asylum, the lunatic asylum even. What began as a patient-analyst relationship grew into a colleagueship and then blossomed into a friendship. They both found that they had similar opinions about their own fields. For Jung, psychology and analysis, even his own analysis, could not answer truly pressing problems such as what is consciousness, what is the meaning of life. And Pauli similarly found that quantum mechanics could not answer similar questions. And so over the next 26 years, Pauli died in 1958 at the age of 58. Over the next 26 years, they pondered these questions, and they delved into alchemy, mysticism, religion, and they discussed these topics and at Jung's mansion, fortress-like mansion on the shores of Lake Zurich with a fog usually billowing in, and they sat in Jung's massive dining room and discussed topics that ranged over physics, psychology, Pauli's dreams, since Pauli underwent a Jungian analysis. Is there a primal number at the foundation of the universe? They discussed Yahweh, Jesus Christ, Armageddon, ESP, UFOs, everything, and over fine wine, fine cigars, wonderful food. And one reason why I wrote this book was to bring their discussions again to the attention of physicists and humanists in general, to indicate how, at a very high level, these topics can be discussed.
It might be a bit uncomfortable in a way for a lot of people who are of the opinion that these topics are generally pseudoscientific and not quite based in reality. But did those sort of discussions have an impact, do you think, on Pauli's scientific work?
Oh, yes, certainly. In dream analysis, Pauli realized, what did Pauli get out of this? Well, Pauli got out of this that he understood his own creativity and understood the forces that drove him, and he became a better person, as he put it. Although he never stopped drinking. And Jung and he, when they got together, they consumed large numbers of bottles of wine. That's fine and good. What Jung got out of it was Jung understood quantum physics better and was able to put some groundwork under a notion that he considered to be the best idea he ever had, namely synchronicity. So they both got something out of it.
Let's just talk a little bit about what Jung's idea of synchronicity is.
Well, Jung's idea of synchronicity was of a meaningful occurrence, and this meaningful occurrence need not be causal in the sense of Western causality, that event A causes event B causes event C, and so on. This is a linear causal system, but Jung, in his vast readings in Far Eastern philosophy, religion, and literature, took to the Chinese notion of a, not a timeline, but a time helix, so to speak, in the sense that here we are sitting in a certain space, at a certain spot at a certain time, and everything that could happen to us is out there, and we just pick certain points, certain events out, like I'm sitting here. Do you think this was preordained from the time I was born that I would be sitting here? Well, maybe, but maybe not. Maybe a large number of occurrences were possible to me, and I moved in a way that was acausal.
It's often said, I mean, there are lots of examples where people who are, you know, have sort of pseudoscientific ideas will use quantum theory, the complications of quantum theory, as explanations and justifications for their ideas. So is that what's going on here? I mean, how would like Pauli have interpreted that idea of Jung's and seen sort of parallels within his work on the quantum?
Well, Pauli took to it. Just to give you some history of it, Jung had been thinking along these lines back in, already back in 1911, 1909 even, and he had tried to influence a young physics department member in 1909 about synchronicity, a person by the name of Albert Einstein, who didn't go for it at all. And in fact, every physicist he spoke to would not go along the acausal line. And then, lo and behold, he came across Wolfgang Pauli, a brilliant young intellectual, a scientist, and Pauli was who Jung was looking for. They didn't begin to discuss. Pauli came to Jung in 1932 and was analyzed face to face for about a year and a half, from 1933 to 1934. And then they met often in the intervening years and exchanged many, many letters. It was not until 1948 that Pauli began to work seriously with Jung on synchronicity, and Pauli had to straighten out a number of points that Jung was getting wrong. Jung called synchronicity simultaneity, synchronicity. And Pauli said, that's wrong. That's a notion from relativity, and that can't fit any psychological theory. What Pauli introduced Jung to was that even in quantum physics, there's a causality, in a sense that if you have a huge collection of atoms, radioactive atoms, for example, you don't know when an individual atom will decay. And if you try and find out when it will decay, you may make it decay. And so that's out of the question. But what you do know is something about a large number of atoms when they will decay. It's called the half-life of a nucleus, when half of the nuclei will decay. And so the point that there can be acausal processes, even in physics, was very inspirational to Jung.
Let's go back a little bit, because you mentioned at the beginning of the interview that how Pauli had written an article about Kepler and how he was particularly fascinated with not just the planetary motion, the scientific ideas of Kepler, and I suppose presumably Newton as well was around at that time and was also part of, was also an alchemist as well as a scientist. And you also mention a character who I've not come across before, Robert Fludd. Let's talk a little bit about Pauli believed that this environment that they were working in at the time is not just an interesting detail, but it's basically integral to their science.
Yes, Pauli very much appreciated the point that these people were working in the last days of the Renaissance, at the onset of the Age of Enlightenment. And so they, so to speak, had one foot in each part. And although they seriously believed in science, they separated that science from the world of alchemy, the world of religion. For example, in the original Copernican universe, the sun-centered universe, the sun is at the center, and everything moves around the sun in a circle. And that was a mess, actually. It didn't give you a lot of advantage over an earth-centered universe. And Kepler came along and then showed that if the planets move around the sun, not in circles, but in a curve that's called an ellipse, it's a flattened circle, and you flatten out the circle and the one center becomes two centers, and the sun is at one of those centers. And that was all fine and good. That got rid of all of the complications in the Copernican system. But it bothered Kepler because the sun was not directly at the center of the universe. So Kepler had his science on the one hand, but he still kept he kept that separate from his religion. The cosmos was still God's playground, so to speak. And that was the case with Newton as well. It was said of Newton that Newton was not the first of the modern scientists, but the last of the magicians. And Newton firmly believed in alchemy. He learned ancient Greek and learned Hebrew to look at biblical chronology to show that the various miracles actually did occur.
So is the suggestion then that Pauli just had an appreciation for the idea that spirituality can help you? You keep them separate, but somehow it helps your creativity and it helps your scientific side as well?
Well, what Pauli believed is that in the age of Enlightenment, the age of rationalism, mysticism had been pushed out of the scientific picture. And a science developed which could discuss, as I said before, dead matter. But you want to now enlarge that picture to bring in biology as well. And Pauli made a comment towards what turned out to be the end of his life that a new mysticism will come into play, not the old mysticism, the old alchemy, but something new, meaning that if you want to explain consciousness, you have to go beyond science as we know it today.
But do you think, though, at all, and I'm sort of looking for your personal opinion on all this, I suppose, but when a scientist who is very well regarded in one field, like Pauli was, then sort of goes to this other field completely, don't you feel that sometimes that can give that new field a false sense of authority to
Pauli
it?
Pauli never discussed this stuff with his colleagues. In fact, he never, ever divulged that he had been in face-to-face analysis with Jung. It was only very close friends knew that he corresponded with Jung, and that became more and more obvious as time went on. And they considered that just as a curious part of a curious person, and that's all. But, I mean, what I believe is that there are questions that science can't answer. And what is the meaning of the world? What is the meaning of our life? What is these couples that we live in, these polarities, light and dark, love and hate, and so on? One should leave one's mind open to go beyond science.
But not so open it falls out.
It can't fall out. It has to be a starting point. It works. It's good for something, but it doesn't say why all the atoms that make up our body produce consciousness, produce feelings, for example. I mean, we're greater than the sum of our parts.
Hmm. Let's look. We before we move on to something else. Let's look at you've mentioned that one of the subjects of the book is significant numbers.
Yes,
and of course. Our listeners could probably work out what one of those numbers is because it's the title of the book. So let's talk about what is significant about the number 137.
Yeah, well, 137 is significant for the following reason. Let me develop this by just saying that if you shine light on a collection of atoms, the collection of atoms will emit light, and you examine that light with what's called a spectroscope. You see lines, they're called spectral lines, and they're the DNA of a particular atom. Now, it turned out that if you examine them with a very, very finely tuned spectroscope, you don't see a single line, you see two lines. You see a splitting, a very fine splitting. That's called the fine structure splitting. The problem was to explain that with a theory of the atom. That was accomplished, and what fell out of that theory was a pure number. And it was the first time that a pure number played such a key role in physics. By a pure number, I mean a number that doesn't have any dimensions attached to it, like length, time, and mass. Since it's a pure number, then if we could communicate, for example, with somebody else in our cosmos, we'll communicate by light, electromagnetic signals, and they will also have a fine structure constant. It'll be called Spock's constant or something else. We don't know what it is. And so it's a number. It's one of these primordial numbers that binds everything together. Now, what makes it interesting, moving outside of science, Jung and Pauli found that if you take the Hebrew letters for the word Kabbalah, and each letter has a numerical component. If you add up all those numbers, you'll get 137. And Pauli was also able to link 137 with the number 4, which is an archetype. And so, therefore, 137 is an archetype as well. So something very special about this number.
It sort of sounds, though, that, I mean, it sounds kind of like the Bible code, things like that, where if you're looking for certain numbers, if you're looking for certain data,
yeah,
you can
crazy
find
things.
It in
the
any...
The Bible code, yeah, it's mentioned in my book. There are crazy ways of getting 137, of knowing the answer beforehand and then making sure you get it.
Right. So, I mean, so would you consider the idea of the Kabbalah thing, I mean, to you, is that simply metaphor? Is that just something
that's interesting in that it occurs... In precisely that way. And you can play the game also. If you take if you write out the Hebrew word for 137 and you add up those letters, then you get 1664, which is 1644, which is a particular verse in the Bible that pertains to the number of the beast and so on. These may be coincidences. One doesn't know, but they're interesting.
It seems like a coincidence, though.
Yeah,
I mean, right?
Or a synchronicity.
Also, a synchronicity. Also, it pops out that... what pops out of physics is that the number 137 as a whole number doesn't as a prime number. Actually, that there are decimal places there.
You're listening to Little Atoms tonight with me, Neil Denny, and Rebecca Watson, and we're talking to Arthur Miller, primarily about his book 137, Jung, Pauli, and the Pursuit of a Scientific Obsession. But Arthur, if we could perhaps move on now to, I'd like to bring in to the discussion your previous book, Einstein, Picasso,
Sure. And.
We've just talked about Pauli and his sort of study of Johannes Kepler and this idea that social milieu that Kepler was working in is sort of integral to his work. And I'd sort of like to raise this idea in the context of Jung and Pauli working and Einstein and Picasso in the, you know, the early 19th century. So let's perhaps talk about how significant the time that these men were working.
Yes,
to
that's a good point. The early 20th century... Both Einstein and Picasso were impelled, swept along, so to speak, by this intellectual tidal wave called the avant-garde. And the basic problem of the avant-garde, basic issue, was to redefine classical intuitions of space and time. And that made an enormous difference in architecture, in music, and literature. And it's no accident that they both worked on the same problem. The nature of space and time, more exactly, the nature of simultaneity. For Einstein, it was a time simultaneity, how you represent two events that occur at the same time but are far apart. And for Picasso, it was a spatial simultaneity, how you can produce on a canvas different perspectives of a scene all at once. And the usual art historical take on this is just totally wrong. And that art historians claim that the roots of Cubism are in Cezanne and African art, and don't say anything more. And this is a very tricky topic now. First of all, let me say immediately that Einstein and Picasso never met each other in 1905 when Einstein did Special Relativity, and 1907 when Picasso did Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, which contained the seeds of Cubism. Neither one knew the other, and Relativity was not an inspiration for Picasso. It simply couldn't have been. It was just a matter of simultaneous work on a problem because they were both impelled by the avant-garde.
So I'll try to bring Jung and Pauli into this equation as well. I mean, they're working at the same time when this art is going, when Cubism and the relative rise of photography as opposed to art, and it's the time of the First World War as well, for instance. I mean, I wonder to what extent, again, that the sort of social conditions that were going on was influential to that.
I think less so in their case, although there are historians that will argue otherwise in the fall of the Weimar Republic and situations like that. Although Pauli began his work in the early days of the Weimar Republic in 1918, although when he made his first big discovery it was 1924. No, I think the social milieu was much less of an influence on Pauli and on Jung as well. Jung's political motivations or political beliefs never played a role in his work. Let me put it that way. But they did come in and sort of spoil his reputation, let's put it, for a while. But certainly with Einstein and Picasso, the social milieu mattered. And what influenced Picasso with developments in science, technology, and in particularly, and very interestingly, developments in four-dimensional geometry. Now, what's very tricky about Picasso is that the way he gave interviews, he would play with an interview. So if an interviewer said, did science, technology, and mathematics affect him, he would say, I never heard of it. And so that's the line of art historians. You never heard of these things. But then art historians will say that, well, African masks were very important. But Picasso also said he didn't know anything about African masks. So you have to be careful. You have to weigh apparent incommensurables. But however, it's ridiculous to think that someone who had a broad-ranging mind like Picasso did and influential and intellectual friends like he did knew nothing about developments in science, technology, and mathematics, which were discussed in newspapers and bandied about in cafes.
And do you see that same sort of relationship between art and science continuing today?
I think it's being picked up today to a very nice extent in that it has never been symmetrical, and it has always been a situation where science drove art, and particularly today, science and art are coming back together again today. Artists are more interested in science than scientists are, but there are a number of scientists like myself who are interested in addressing this imbalance. But there's also a lot of really bad art and art science being produced now, particularly by artists who don't have the faintest idea about science will produce something, for example, a bunch of spaghetti and call it string theory. So this calls for a very close collaboration between artists and scientists.
Like, I don't know if you're familiar with MIT. I think they have an artist
the
in residence
of visual arts.
There.
That's very good. And I have an art exhibition coming up in Berlin as well in September. Yeah.
What sort of art do you do?
I work with an artist by the name of Fiorella Lovato, and we're doing work that concerns astrophysics and quantum physics, and the exhibit is called Weaving the Universe from Atoms to Stars.
So this has been a key area of your research across your career, is this idea of the theory of a cognitive science for creative thinking. Mm-hmm. And you have an idea called the network model. So let's talk about what that is.
Well, the network model is based on four cycles of thinking. And Pauli discussed part of this, actually, in some of his work. We work on a problem consciously, then we may get stuck on it, and the experienced researcher will stop work, but work is only stopped consciously. The intense and passionate desire to solve a problem keeps it alive in the unconscious, where there are less barriers to putting facts together. So there are lines of parallel yet intersecting lines of thought, and that's part of my network model. And then an illumination hopefully results, and then verification is a conscious effort. So the network model discusses parallel but intersecting lines of thought. And I've considered cases of Einstein discovering relativity, for example, and Picasso discovering cubism.
That was, an interesting... I saw that in an interview with you where you talked about Picasso discovering cubism rather than...
Rather than creating it.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, there's a difference between discovery and creation. I mean, you create a Ford motor car, but you discover intellectual quantities. And Picasso was an intellectual artist. And cubism was an avowedly scientific, mathematical research program whose aim was to reduce forms to geometry. And the forms that they reduced it to, the geometrical forms, are eternal forms. I mean, geometry isn't eternally. You might say geometry is an archetype. These forms were out there waiting to be discovered. And what Picasso was trying to do is to discover a reality beyond appearances, which only certain intellectual artists try to accomplish.
So are we basically talking about the process of creative thinking is ostensibly the same, be you a visual artist or a particle physicist?
Yes. At the moment, at that nascent magical moment of creativity, both artists and scientists think along the same lines, along conceptual lines. And that is what Einstein and Picasso did. And what's going on today is that it's important, as I said before, in these artist-scientist collaborations for the scientists to make suggestions to drive the artist.
And you think that the science is going to benefit as much as the artist, presumably?
Well, there will come a time. I think right now it's mostly the artist that benefits from it. But there certainly will come a time when there will be artist-scientists, we live in a visual world, and there will emerge somehow or another a logic in which you can discuss the truth and falsity of images. I mean, you'll just work with the screen.
And I think if we think of famous scientists that people really know and love, they tend to think of the most dynamic and creative thinkers, even up to modern days. Like when you think of Carl Sagan, I think of someone who's really creative. Richard Feynman, people like that.
They think visually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point for us to end on. We're out of time. We've been talking to Arthur Miller about his book 137, Jung, Pauli and the Pursuit of Scientific Obsession. And we've been talking about Einstein, Picasso, his earlier book. Arthur, thank you very much for appearing on Little Atoms today.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.